We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
My name is Jari Bolander. Welcome to the Entrepreneur Ethos Podcast. On this podcast, we're going to take a deep dive into the traits, values, beliefs, and skills of all sorts of entrepreneurs to learn how to build a more ethical, inclusive, and resilient world. Let's get started.
On this episode of the podcast, I speak with Anupam Kundu, founder of RealValue.ai, which is building a visual intelligence platform to measure and optimize human experiences. He is a trained engineer and soon realized that he was not that great at programming, but loved thinking of new ideas, building products, and solving problems. After taking a course at MIT on AI, he realized that he wanted to build his own company. So he quit his job to pursue that dream, even though he did not have a product in mind. That led him to start offering consulting services to figure out the problems that customers were running into and how AI could solve them. He soon realized that the rat race of Silicon Valley was not making him or his family happy. That realization led him to move to France, where he lives now and runs his company with his co-founder and wife. We talk about the challenges of running a company with your spouse, as well as living in a foreign country, all while trying to build a company. Now, let's get better together. Anupam Kundu, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I, met you through Founders Network, and you're actually in France right now, which we'll talk about in a second, because I find it super fascinating, you know, why people go to different countries and kind of what you're working on. And you actually are doing some stuff related to COVID, and I want to hear all about that as well, because it's really cool, you know, how what you're doing, you kind of stepped up for that. But before we get into that, tell us a little bit about how you're doing what you're doing. How'd you get to this place in your life?
Yeah, that's an interesting journey, right? I'm in my early 40s, so yeah. I think I'll just go with the professional part, where I started my professional journey as a programmer. I was writing billing for telecom systems, right, where you can put one bill for your cell phone, for your TV, for your home phone, for your security systems and everything, right? Back in 1999, 2000, those things were novelty, and I was writing those things. But after 3-4 years doing that and implementing those solutions, I realized that I am not a great programmer,
Oh, you realize that too. I realized the same thing.
Yeah, I kind of realized that I was good with other things, right? Negotiation, putting up things on the board, charting and things like that, right? So, and I was back in India then, and I was doing these implementations in US. So I went back to India after 3.5 years of doing these things. And then I joined the MBA program and I left my job and joined IBM Global Services as a consultant. And so after that, I was like, I had to do minimal programming for another 5-7 years, right? And because I was still at IBM. And then I ended up doing other things, but I ended up running into a company called ThoughtWorks. And for the people who do not know, if you have ever heard of Martin Fowler, the guy who wrote Design Patterns book, or the guy who signed the Agile Manifesto.
ThoughtWorks
is, Martin's company.
Okay. And, interesting.
Martin is a chief scientist there. They recently sold it off to a private equity firm, I think 2 years back. That kind of changed my life. So I got sucked into product management, how to do agile product management. I started writing things, speaking at conferences, and I was there for 8 years, the longest I've been with any company employed.
Yeah, that's like eternity in startup years.
And when I left, I was actually running a piece of business for them, financial services, all the accounts for financial services together with someone else. So that kind of exposed me to a whole lot of different things of how to create products, how to run businesses, how to go and sell, how to pitch, how to build teams, all of those other things which I didn't know before, right? And so that was a very interesting moment in my life, I would say, those years. So I got a little greedy. I was in East Coast primarily, New York City area. I got a little greedy. I moved to West Coast and I joined a company, another consulting firm. The lure was that I would get to work with Google. And I did end up working with Google for this particular consulting firm. I did almost like 220 to 240 people team at Google.
Wow.
Google and Ericsson and Wiala and big money, right? Like, so it was like too much going on, and ended up doing partnership with Google Cloud, Apigee, a bunch of different companies. And at some point, I think when I left, the portfolio was about $40 million.
Wow.
Work. Yeah. And so so at that point, there was no day and night for me, right? Like, and I got married. I had a son. We moved from East Coast to West Coast when he was 4 months old. And with this kind of life, my French wife was not happy.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And we started kind of looking at the things in a different way, in the sense of like, you know, what are we doing here? Like, we're making all this money being in Silicon Valley. We're hanging out with the best and the brightest of people that you can ever think of meeting. We're living in Palo Alto, like everybody dreams of being here. But what are we actually doing? We're not getting the time to spend with each other. I'm not getting the time to spend with my son as much as I would like. And I want to build a startup of my own that has been a dream for a long time. And to do things, you know, to build things ourselves. And so I did a course at MIT for AI business strategy and all of this. I met some interesting people and I quit.
Okay.
There goes $250,000 of a salary into zero.
Yeah, yeah. Go big or go home.
Right there, right? Yeah. And so we started this company and we started doing mostly AI consulting, data strategy consulting, data privacy consulting. And the whole thing was because I didn't know what to build. I didn't have a product idea. Like, you know, some people wake up and they have a product vision, like, I want to build this. And I didn't have it. I was like, maybe the customers will tell me what to build and then we will build. let's go and find the problem that we can solve, actually. And so we solved some problems. We solved some VC problems. We solved some retail problems. We built some tools and things like that. And eventually we realized that, okay, there is computer vision seems to be very powerful. We can solve a lot of different things. And it could be interesting to solve human problems rather than just using pure object detection things, right? So we kind of, I would say, pivoted a little bit and started building a platform that is more about understanding human behavior in physical space.
I don't know if, did you mention the name of the company? I don't recall if you did or not.
It's called Real Value, realvalue.ai.
Okay. Realvalue.ai. Okay.
Yeah. So my co-founder and I run it. My co-founder also happens to be my wife.
Wow. Oh, we got to talk about that.
Yes. She's the CEO. I'm the head of product. That's it. We have been running this now for a year and few. We have done some interesting work. So we moved to France. We figured out the cost of running a startup is cheaper in France than in Palo Alto.
Really?
Yeah.
I would not have guessed that.
Yes. And interestingly enough, obviously because she has a home and all that stuff in France, so there is I'm not paying Palo Alto rent.
Yeah, true.
Right. Yeah. The good thing is the entire team is remote. A couple of people in the Valley, a couple of people in India, a couple of people in France. Our sales guy is in Prague. So it's completely remote team. It's been actually a joyful learning experience working with a completely remote team. Right? Just two of us are here. And obviously, when co-founders are a couple, it's bittersweet relationships. I mean,
yeah, no, it can be. Never the closest I came to running a company with a spouse was my late wife Jane, and I basically
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, she passed away 3 years ago from leukemia, and I basically helped her run the company when she got sick. So we worked together, but it was sort of her company and I was the face of it because I could go outside. You know, she didn't have an immune system because, you know, she was going through chemo and then a bone marrow transplant and all that sort of stuff. And so what's happening now with all this shelter in place and the COVID stuff is very familiar to me because it was exactly what we had to do when she was sick, when she had, leukemia, because basically you have no immune system, so you get sick at any time. So we had to wear the mask and wash your hands and clean the surfaces. And, it's very similar. She was sequestered for a while when she was going through her transplants. And so it was, it's a tough one.
I mean, it's a tough experience. Yeah.
Yeah. But also working with your spouse is, I learned a lot about, I learned a lot about boundaries.
Yes. And I think you have to have that mode where you can seamlessly switch on and off between personal and professional. And what's your, a question could shift into, how do you answer this one? Ultimately, there is a, or how do I treat this one? I mean, and the main reason she's the co-founder is because she's extremely capable. And just I have no shame about accepting that I learned a lot, and I personally believe that if I was running this alone, I wouldn't have been as successful or borderline successful of where we are.
Oh yeah,
a little bit getting without her. Right.
Totally. No, I get that. I mean, Jane was actually a little upset because the best year that JSY PR and marketing ever had was when she was sick and I was running the company. She was a little upset, but I'm like, there's because it's two of us running it, right? I mean, it's, you know, before you were just yourself and your sole proprietor kind of thing and one person show. And now you've got two of us. And, but boy, we had a lot of discussions. Because we were both like type A driven. I'm sure same with, yeah. I mean, that's why I want to talk more about it. Cause what have you found that had the, what kind of conversations did you have to have, or do you have to have with your spouse / co-founder on keeping that balance? Cause I found it really hard.
Yeah. I think, you know, a lot of people think that spouses should not start a business. Couples cannot be entrepreneurs together and all of these other things. Right. And I find it to be weird. Like, Y Combinator, Paul Graham and his wife used to run it.
Mm. That I did not know.
Amazon, McKinsey and Jeff Bezos. I mean, yes, they kind of went their own way last year. But they had equity in that. That means she was a co-founder, a big co-founder. Not because just she was a wife.
Right.
So it's interesting, right? Like, there's a lot of success stories of, I think the stories are not being shared enough and told enough, because people usually think like if they are spouses, oh, it must be hard. And it is hard. Don't get me wrong. It is hard. But what I've found is that it's maybe because she has a different background. She comes from a design, fashion, communication background, marketing background, while my background is more technology, product, sales, general management.
Yeah.
And I think it kind of feed off each other a little bit, till we have frictions about should we go for this particular customer or how we should write this email, how will that piss that person off if we write this, right? Like, things like that obviously comes up. But and then there are critical decisions of like, where do we spend money?
Yeah.
Right. For example, that's a key decision as a startup, right? Where do we spend money? Do we spend money on marketing? Do we spend money on product development? Do we hire one more sales consultant? Do we go and pay tax consultant? Where do we pay money? And I think those are the heated conversations. But I would again say that if I were alone, maybe there would have been, like, I may have run a little bit faster at certain times, or she alone, but I think together we just have the potential to go longer, which is interesting for me. I've never thought of it like that till I kind of ended up in this state, right? Like, where I'm like, well, I was like, okay, if I made that decision, I would have done this, and oh my god, I would have missed this thing totally, and I would have hit the wall.
Oh yeah, no. Continued. Totally. No, I mean, the rule that I learned was when my spouse is nervous about something or doesn't want me to do something, they're always right, because it happened time and time again where, you know, I mean, I was married before I married Jane. So even my ex-wife, like, she always was really astute in attune to what was in our best interest. And when I didn't listen to her, it always ended poorly. So I'm like, rule number one, always listen to your spouse, because your spouse, if of course they love you and it's in that kind of relationship, is pretty much got your best interest at heart, because it's their best interest. So.
Yeah. And I think I lucked out. I think we lucked out on many of these things. I have heard horror stories also, just with co-founders, forget spouses, right?
Horror
stories around that.
Yeah.
So I think this is also because we kind of realize that this is something that we want to do. We do not want to do a job. We do not want to go and work for someone necessarily. Like, and we would probably get annoyed at their dumbness of doing things, you know?
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. I know what you mean.
And so we're like, maybe this is the only way we can do something, like, and stay sane. And so that's how it happened. And to be honest, she left her job in France to move to New York to be with me when she decided to move to US. And I also feel like this is a way for me to kind of give back a little bit. That makes any sense.
No, it does. It does.
Like I'm in France now. I don't speak the language. I'm trying to learn. There is COVID. I cannot go out of the house. It's like you're stuck here, right? In many ways. And it's trying to make the best of it. So.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is definitely different when you are in another country that's not your home country, right? I mean, yep. and having to sort of, I mean, it's amazing that you're starting a startup in France, because with all the challenges that the French government puts in the way of innovation, I mean, there's just so many, I know some people that kind of do some of that. You're the first one I've talked to like about this in-depth thing, because most of them are just like, oh yeah, it's horrible. and then it stops there.
It is horrible. I mean, don't get me wrong. It is way worse than Silicon Valley.
Oh yeah, no, for sure.
Significantly worse.
Yeah.
I mean, the money is still the old money. The money is not like new money, right? And not the tech money. It's the fashion money, pharmaceutical money.
Yeah.
And people are very like pedagogical, and you always have to have some deep theoretical understanding of something to even say something. And if you don't speak French, God help you.
So. Well, I remember trying to speak French one time when I was there, and I was trying hard. Like I understand, English as a first language for me can be challenging, right? So I get it. I'm not the best language person, but I remember we were sitting there. We wrote out what we wanted to do. We wanted to order in French, feel the experience. And I remember I'm reading the thing, kind of struggling, and the waiter's like, oh, you don't need to do that. I speak English. And I'm like, gosh, damn, I feel so bad. But I tried, and then I moved on. Like after that, I'm like,
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, I think that was also something that I realized, that a lot of people here actually wants to speak English.
Yeah, totally. Yeah,
which is good. I was just like, okay, I can get away with some of that. I mean, I did some, I taught some classes to some students at a local robotics AI university here, and I gave my entire lecture in English, right? And I was like, and I had to translate. I had a translator open in one of the screens and show them from time to time, like if I saw blank face, like, hey, can you explain to me like what I just said? And
yeah. So,
it was fun actually. But in general, I would say like what is good in France is that France has a very good safety net.
Mm.
In the sense of social safety net is incredible. Right. And if you are plugged in with the local chamber of commerce, which you did, and then you go into French tech, you go into like local chambers of commerce, and you go into some incubator, and you win a hackathon that which we did like three months back. We won another hackathon, which was international between France and Spain, and we won it. And so they gave us incubation space and all of this good stuff. And then you slowly start to build that network, and they start to kind of trust you. And I think it works that Lisa is from France, I'm from America, and they look at Silicon Valley, and it kind of, there's that aura around that, oh, they're a mixed couple and they're doing things differently.
Yeah.
So they bring in a different way of thinking, and kind of if I do something stupid, I get away with that. Like, okay, this guy doesn't know what he's doing, right? Is American.
Yeah, exactly. Those Yahoo Americans. We could talk about stories from France all day, because like there was one time we were at this cafe, and we'd been going to this cafe. It was close to our little apartment that we rented, and we would go there every day, and like getting to sort of know the people that work there. And I'm trying to order only in French, so I can, I can say espresso and pain chocolat. So I can eat a pastry and eat and drink espresso, right? That, and we're trying really hard to, just because, like my ex-wife was originally, her family was from Hungary, and you know, so we were trying to fit in. And we were there one day, and there's this bunch of these Yahoo Americans. and the person behind the counter can't understand them. And so, of course, what does an American do? They just speak louder. Yeah. We're like, oh, it's not, oh, like, oh, no. Oh, yeah. Felt so bad. Yeah,
but I appreciate certain things, you know. Like, I really learned to appreciate the food.
Oh, yeah. Food's great.
Food is remarkably great. Like, mm-hmm. everything I eat, I taste it, and I find it to be excellent. I'm like, oh my god! Like, and people actually take their time to eat.
Yes,
they sit at a table and a chair and enjoy the sunshine and
yes,
food, yes. And then they go back and walk.
Yeah, yeah. That was the one thing that was always like, you had the table for the night. They never rushed you, right?
No. They never. And if you're sitting down for lunch, they will never tell you to go. Like,
yeah.
So some of those things I do enjoy. Barcelona is close by, so you should go to Barcelona a few different times.
Mm.
But now with COVID, I think it's not going to open before September, the borders.
No, not at all. I think it's going to be closed for a while in that regard. So tell me about this hackathon that you guys won. I mean, was how you said you won one a 3 months ago, but there was a more current one, or did I miss that?
Yes.
Okay.
No. The 3 months ago was more between Spain and France, which was around tourism, like what can AI do for tourism? And our solution was very simple that, hey, you know, Google kind of takes your mobile data and shows you different places, how busy they are, right? And they have historic data and they can predict taking your mobile data. Why do that? You have CCTV cameras and you have other things inside your premises. You can actually do an occupancy calculation and use that to send it to your customers and whatnot to tell them when these places are busy. And then they want to make a premium appointment. They can make a premium appointment using face recognition or something, that face verification or something like that. And then they get an entry at 2 o'clock when they come in because they have made this appointment and all that. So it was kind of a queue buster for museums and touristic places and all this stuff.
Oh, okay. Queue. Yeah. Oh, line, sorry.
Line. Line buster. Yeah, and the whole idea is that Spain and France happens to be, I think Spain has like 10% or 12% of GDP on tourism.
Yeah.
France also has a significant, I forgot the number. And so they were looking for like how AI can work in tourism, and our solution was okay. And now that you look back at it, we are like, okay, that is the solution for even COVID.
Because, yeah, 100%.
Right. So we're thinking about what we could do for COVID. And then this call came around like, hey, EU versus virus, hack something. And do something around business continuity, and how can you bring back employees and customers right to physical business premises, and how do you create that confidence, create that trust? And the solution we pitched was very simple: have a device that does it all. It can tell you whether you're wearing a mask. It can detect your temperature. It can have an ultrasonic sensor that will push the hydrogels on your hand.
Wow.
And once all of this is done, the Bluetooth will open the door.
Huh.
Because you have a Bluetooth enabled gate.
Right.
So we built that all like over the weekend.
The hardware too?
No, not the hardware.
Okay, just crazy, the, man. I was going to say that's pretty amazing. Like,
no, so that was a solution. Like, so you come in and then we realize that temperatures are not the right thing to do because number one, temperature sensors are extremely expensive, $800
for really?
Temperature camera. Yes, like a thermal camera.
Oh yeah, no, you got to use different ones than that.
Yes, and temperature sensors. temperature usually doesn't tell you that if you have COVID. And plus, if you have COVID and if you have temperature, you should not be there at
the you're feeling pretty bad at that point. That you've crossed the threshold into
to be in the hospital, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, for sure. I mean, what it was interesting is that there was a company that was monitoring the temperature of cancer patients. One of the main challenges with chemo and all that sort of stuff is that you don't have an immune system. Therefore, if you get any like a fever, they need to know about it because typically it could be a reaction or you have an infection and it could be like a thousand. But they, you know, one company was measuring the temperature of people. I think they had a little wristband. So,
yeah. So we wanted to build what we pitched it as a touchless, hassle-free, secure, and safe access management, right? And we wanted to make it GDPR compliant.
Yep.
So everything would be anonymous. We didn't do face verification. Hmm. We did everything else. Right. The idea was that face verification, even if we do it, we'll do it locally. Just so that you know, all our algorithms usually run locally. We never run our algorithms.
Oh, so it's like an embedded system approach or?
It's like an edge processing.
Edge processing. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So we actually did some work with some event company and all this stuff, but we ran the algorithms always locally.
Uh-huh.
Though we have, I think we got through Founders Network, thanks, 100,000 from Google Cloud, which we have extended from 1 year to 2 years.
Yeah.
We have not, we still have everything on the cloud, but we don't run the final algorithm as part of the solution on the cloud. Because in Europe, it's just a big taboo.
Oh, I can only imagine how crazy it is in Europe for that.
Oh my God. You're sending the video to cloud? Get out of my premises. Exactly. They'll throw you out. We had this with one of our customer. We went in and we just said, we have edge processing. We do everything here. Here is our server. Here's everything. But we will have the dashboard on the cloud.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
You will send the data to the cloud? Yeah, but these are numbers. Even if it's stolen, nobody cares. What will you do with these numbers? It doesn't give anyone's personal identity whatsoever. And then his comment was, I've been running this shop for 30 years. We have everything in-house. I would need the permission from the minister.
Yeah, I know. Crazy, huh?
And luckily, we spoke with the municipality before, so the minister was okay. But yeah, it's like that. So you cannot do things where you are sending personal data to. And I think in the US, it's like so different. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, do whatever. Yeah. As long as people agree to it, you're cool. Right? Yes. I mean, which has its own challenges. I mean, you can move fast, but you also have a lot of, part of the reason Zoom was having security problems, right? Because they didn't really account for that. And in their defense, you know, their business today is way different than it was 3 months ago because, you know, they weren't enterprise level type. I mean, it was, it was for startups and, freelancers.
I mean, they are like the disruptor to the WebEx of the world.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
The WebEx. Now they have become the WebEx.
Yeah, yeah. And if you look at WebEx, WebEx is enterprise built. It's got all the GDPR. It's got all the security. I mean, it's heavy lifting. It's heavy iron, right? It's pretty crazy. The case study for data protection and security is definitely what happened to Zoom. I mean, it's just crazy.
Yes. And I think in the Silicon Valley also, I don't know whether it's a Zuckerberg thing or whether it has been there for ages, is like there has been this concept of build fast and break things.
Yep.
I think that when you build fast, you probably neglect a lot of things.
You cut a lot of corners.
Yes. And these things are probably people are getting much more conscious, I guess. I think the way people have that conversation in Europe is very different. I got my naturalized citizenship in US after 13 years, right? So I've lived in US and I've seen that carve, and but in Europe, people really, really value about their data.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a different relationship to it, I think. And as you mentioned, in France, there's this social safety net. There's a lot more. I mean, it's just a different attitude, right? They have certain cultural norms that are just the way it is, right? So
And history probably has a lot to do with it.
Oh yeah, they've fought a lot of wars for that, for sure. A lot of revolutions.
I think so. That's interesting. So we built this thing, and we got the prize in business continuity. Business continuity was one of the challenge areas in that hackathon, and so we got the prize.
Wow.
We were declared as a winner. There were about 2,500 projects, 25,000 people.
Wow.
Yes, it was a huge, so just from a feeling good standpoint, I think it's pretty good.
No, I'd say number one out of, thousands of people. I think you can brag a little about that. No problem. Right. Humble brag.
So we felt good, and we thought there would be some money or something like that, right? Like, this is really good. We could get some money. And then we realized that the money was not like money. It was more like, okay, we'll become a part of European Innovation Council or something like that. And now they are going to pair us up with customers and partners and funders and corporates and all. So it's like a process that they will take you through.
Yeah.
And so the opportunity funnel is bigger, I would guess, right? So you'd get to meet people that you would probably have not met. And in Europe, it's not, the European Union is not as closely tied as United States of America, right? So
yes,
they speak different languages and they have different norms, and we would have probably not got access to the inter-European market, but we are guessing that we would get access to some of the other markets that we had not thought of before. So that could open up.
Oh yeah, totally.
That's the win, I guess. Yeah.
Well, I mean,
it's exciting for us. I mean, because we never thought of that we will actually win. The weird story is, on the same weekend, we participated at another hackathon, which was run by Techstars.
Okay.
Startup weekend.
Yeah, yeah.
Techstars startup weekend. We pitched the same project. There were 150 teams, I think, and we came into the top 40, but we didn't win anything.
Huh.
Right? And I was like, okay. The Techstars was more, Techstars Startup Week in France, it was more like a France kind of audience, right?
Yeah.
So the European audience. So I do not know. I'm not judging anyone, but
no.
Sure, there are valid reasons for why we didn't win. I mean, there are always valid reasons for things happening.
Who knows?
Yeah. And so it was surprising that we participated in two hackathons over the weekend, and we gave the same pitch, because obviously we're not going to make two solutions for both of them. That's not feasible. And we won in one. I guess we increased our odds by participating in two.
Yeah, and it just goes to show you that it's not really about the effort. It's about, let me take that back. For some people, it's one thing. For someone else, it's another thing. It just depends on what the needs are. I think that's the best, actually the best example of needs of the customer or needs of the competition. I mean, to win in one out of, thousands, and then to place in the top 40 out of a couple of hundred, it just goes to show you that they were focused on something else. So still good, I think. I mean, again, this game, as it's all about opportunity. And when you get an opportunity, that you have the skills and the talent to take advantage of it, that's how you get lucky. It's not like anyone's any more lucky than anyone. They just get more opportunity. And I think now, even during the COVID stuff, we need to give people more opportunity to kind of get these wins and have solutions like what you guys did. I mean, I find it super fascinating that, you have all this great technology, and now you're just trying to figure out, how it can be applied. And so, when you look at that, I mean, you're in France, you're under lockdown. So what and you're trying to run a company, and you know you're foreign, and you have all the things that are like, boy, this is going to be a lot tougher. What do you do daily? Like, what are some of the habits that you've found that have been successful, especially, you know, given the situation you're in?
With COVID, I think all our usual things have changed.
Yeah,
right.
For sure.
I have found it to be, like people say, work from home. I don't think we are working from home anymore. We are working from home school.
Hmm.
We have a son.
Yeah.
So we are working from home school, and we take turns in spending time with him. And so basically our hours are not set, which is not the right thing to do, but that's how it is. Like we end up working more in the night than in the day. Well, we end up working when he sleeps. So things are like that. But in general, I would say the biggest thing that, which has really, really worked for us. I hate to call a solution or something like that, but Slack has been extremely helpful just to run a remote team and kind of keep always in touch and know what's happening and people leaving a question and getting it resolved. Not at the same time, but still getting it resolved. Everybody knows that they're in different time zones and they have to get their stuff done. I mean, just the entire tech infrastructure ecosystem, I think, worked out well. I don't think this could have been done, 10 years back. Like, no GitHub, no 10, 15 years back, no GitHub, no Slack, no cloud. Like, how do you do these things?
I don't think it could have happened 5 years ago, to be honest.
Yeah. And so so 5 years back. So I think that's to me is, there's a lot of things that can be done now. Which you speak of opportunities, right? Which I think as an entrepreneur, as a startup builder, I think is rare to have all of this kind of the available to you right now for a little bit of money. And you could probably get some amount of funding from a local chamber of commerce or some government funding or do something interesting and get a grant or get to the right audience. Which I think these are some of the things. And we have always been very, very focused about what is out there for us to do to prove our credibility. I don't know whether Silicon Valley like it or not. Like, as I said, like we have never been very, very strong about, this is what we want to build, right? We have always been like, let's figure out what the problem is, what they're trying to ask for, what they're trying to solve for, and build a solution that we think could solve the problem and get the feedback to adjust it, which is part of my consulting background and part of Lisa's marketing background. But I think that thing is very important, that we have been very adaptable, very, very adaptable to say that we are not going to build something till we find out that there is a need.
Hmm. And you think, I mean, you have to make those decisions sometimes daily. I mean, I guess from a hackathon point of view,
that's true. We make the decisions daily.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I'll give you an example, right? So based on that hackathon, we have some prospects and we are building something which is a little bit more robust. Right, the hackathon was hackathon. We are putting some hardware and things like that at the back of it, and we realized that we need to change some security, some APIs, and all of that. Right, and we are writing it because we were holding it back for last 1.5 weeks. We're not writing it because now we have very close to a contract, let's say, mm-hmm. right, and we know that we have to deliver. And so now this would be our, let's say, first and second customer for the hackathon product that we pitched, right? If that is so, and now we are building all of it, right? And we didn't build it before. We had a model that can detect masks, that can help with temperature. We have a model that can open a gate, or an algorithm that can open a gate, but we never kind of, put them together. And so we are putting it together right now. Because the hackathon thing was more, as you said, like just to write the software and show a video that it works.
Hmm. Yeah, it is. It is kind of interesting how just little things like that can change kind of your focus. I know just in general, I'm way more busy nowadays than I was before. And it's just can be kind of insane how fast things go. I mean, just accelerating even more, even though everything's quote unquote shut down. You know, people are looking for things like for what you just said. I mean, I can only imagine how how much more, you know, features and functions there people are going to want as they kind of get dig into it. So it's an interesting, you know, heuristic to follow that, you know, we're not going to get like kind of locked into anything until we kind of know what the need is. And I think that's a real important thing because the need is always going to drive the solution. I've never seen it any other way.
Yeah. And I think we can see some of the things that we think people will expect, like this temperature thing was a no-brainer for us, right? We went ahead and put in orders. We're about to put in orders. We inquired with 7 companies across the globe, and we wanted not to go to China.
Yeah.
As a value statement, we said we'll not go to China. We'll source it from either Europe or US. Right. Where and we went out and we was about to put in orders at Seek, at Flare, at a bunch of others. And then the more we spoke to the people who were actually going to buy the solution, they said, "Hey, temperature is not that important for me." Actually, for example, at a school we talked about, and they said at university, they said, like, what happens if the kids are running and they come in and their temperature is higher? Would I not allow him to the lecture hall? And I were like, yeah, but that's your decision, not I'm just showing you the temperature. They were like, no, we don't want to see the temperature.
Okay.
Yeah, so you know, like things like that, and then you're like, okay, maybe temperature we can downplay and come in version 2. And to be honest with you, we have not particularly very, very skilled with Android.
Right.
We had one developer who knows Android. We are more into like Python and OpenCV and building our models and creating data sets and things like that.
Right.
And now we have delved into this world where we pitched an idea and it won, and we think like, okay, it has legs. It probably has wings also. So we are now writing Android libraries, and people are cursing me, telling like, dude, you're doing a pivot in the middle of COVID. And I'm like, what do you mean by COVID? And what do you mean by pivot? We are just extending our product because there is a customer demand for it.
Yeah. I mean, I love it. Well, you got to be flexible and dynamic being a startup, I mean, for sure. There's no question that if you're not comfortable with the uncomfortableness of this all, then this is the wrong job, because it's always about things change so quickly. And again, I really appreciate your time today. I mean, it took us a little while to get this set up, but, you know, great talking to you, great understanding what you're doing. Congratulations on the hackathon win, and the products that you're trying to, you know, bring to market as rapidly as you can are going to help a lot of people. So stay safe. And thanks again for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Jerry. I really appreciate your time, and you have been a wonderful host.
Well, I appreciate that. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Entrepreneur Ethos podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did creating it. My hope is that you learned something that can make you a little bit better. If you enjoyed the podcast, please do share it with friends and review it on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also join my email list by visiting thedailymba.com to get my thoughts on what I'm doing to get better, as well as what I'm working on. You can also pick up my book, The Entrepreneur Ethos, if you want to learn the traits, values, and beliefs that I think we need to build a more ethical, inclusive, and resilient entrepreneur, and frankly, world community. Feel free to follow me on Twitter at TheDailyMBA, and let me know if you have any questions or recommendations for a guest that you'd like me to talk to. Also, drop me a note if you try anything we talked about in this or any other episode. I'd love to hear what's working for you. Until next time, keep getting better.
Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, and Thomas Hearns. Legends, whose four-way rivalry defined one of the greatest eras in boxing history. Relive their decade of dominance in a new Showtime sports documentary, The Kings, a four-part series now streaming on Showtime.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring this podcast. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System, you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. At hundreds of locations across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unifiedhealing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.